I was astonished, to be honest. I remember when we were filming it, I just couldn't believe that what was happening and that people were willing to expose themselves in this way. And there was a real contraction afterwards. I think people were kind of in shock, like, oh my God, what did I just do? And I know there's people when they saw the footage were, you know, it was hard for them to see it.
What do you do when the thing you've been working towards for years turns out to not be what you wanted after all? David Sutcliffe started out as an athlete, a jock, but circumstances derailed that and David was forced to seek another path. He fell into acting. He was good at it, and dedicated too, and after struggling in the industry for a long time, first in his native Canada and then in the United States, he found success. Landing roles on various TV shows, including Friends, CSI, and a major role on Gilmore Girls. But something was eating David. Success was not all that he thought it would be. Something was missing, something wasn't quite right. Acting wasn't quite right. And so David's journey took another turn, this time towards self-exploration and therapy, a journey that eventually led him to finding a new path as a therapy facilitator, as well as to producing a documentary series about this work. We talked to David about core energetics, a form of body psychotherapy that David practices, and why it's become central to his life. We also talk about Group, the documentary series he created about this work. We touch on why Fight Club continues to be relevant today, on Jordan Peterson, and on why the villain is the most important character in a film. Part filmmaking discussion and part therapy session. That was our chat with David. And this is your Doc Pod.
Exactly. Yeah.
Did you grow up with both parents or in a single parent household?
I grew up, my parents split when I was six, and then my mom remarried around the time I was 12, and then they split when I was about 18. So I definitely grew up with instability in the house.
Brothers, sisters?
I have a younger brother, 2 years younger, and then I have two half-brothers. My father remarried and had two more boys, and they live in Saskatoon, Canada, which is in the middle of the country, quite a distance away from Toronto.
Did you have much contact with your father when you were growing up?
Not really. I mean, once my stepdad came into the picture, that's when my dad ended up moving back to his hometown of Saskatoon, and I didn't have, I mean, I had, it was, my stepfather was great. He stepped in and did a great job, you know, became a strong father figure in my life, but it's not the same as your real father. So, I mean, I definitely have a lot of emotional stuff around not having my father around growing up.
Did you feel that absence while you were young, or is it something that came up later on?
I don't think I was really aware of it at the time. I think it's so painful to a child. You essentially disassociate from it. But looking back on it, yeah, I can see how much of a longing that I had to be around my father and how, you know, as children, we often interpret our parents leaving or one of the parents leaving as something that there's something wrong with us. There's something inherently wrong with us. And it, you know, that obviously is deeply unconscious, but through a lot of therapy, I came to really see how painful it was to not have my father around. My mother, you know, she did a great job, but she was young and overwhelmed. And so there was a lot of stability and uncertainty. So I grew up with that, you know, sort of fear, not having that masculine presence. It was difficult. It was destabilizing, and it's definitely had an impact on my life, on my personality, you know, on my well-being. I'm somebody who can have bouts of anxiety and depression. And I don't want to say it's all because of that, but I think, you know, that I mean, from my experience, the early childhood experiences definitely have an impact on our well-being later in life.
Yeah. The saying goes, give me a boy at seven and I'll give you the man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it takes the first 6 years are really crucial in the development. And so, yeah. And like I said, just the uncertainty, the instability, and even when, you know, he was there for the first 6 years, but my father was an alcoholic. And so he was distant, you know, he wasn't as present as I would have liked him to have been. My mother was more the dominant personality, but of course, you know, she was going through her own, they were both very young and she was going through her own struggles with him. And in that way, I'm sure was not present for us as well. So, I mean, you feel that as a kid, you know, you can't really hide that energy is in the field, it's in the home, and the kids can feel it, whether they're conscious of it or not, and they're going to have a reaction to it.
Something that people who grew up with both parents often don't understand is that growing up without a father is not a neutral position, like a zero.
Yeah.
An absent father still has an impact, but it's a negative impact. It leaves an absence, a hole in the child's life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm still coming to terms with it, you know, because I think a child, you know, we want to love our parents. I wanted to love my father. I wanted to be close to my father. Children, you know, they idolize their parents and particularly a boy with his father. And when you only have your mother around who, you know, she's a woman, she doesn't get me or see me in quite the same way as a man would. So I felt that lack. And as a kid, there's really nothing to do about it. This is the situation you're in and you have to do what you have to do to survive. This is the reality. And so I cut off from a lot of those feelings. It felt like I wasn't allowed to really love my father because he wasn't there. And, you know, even if I wanted to, the pain of not having him there was too much to bear. So I cut off from a lot of feelings and I think ended up causing me to have a lot of anger later in life and frustration and feeling like I didn't have support, that I had to do everything, you know, by myself. Like, I was a loner in a sense. And it's definitely, I mean, I have great relationships with men. I mean, fortunately, I grew up playing sports. So that camaraderie with men was something that I, you know, I had access to at an early age and developed a lot of bonds with men. But that older man, that mentor, that guide, that father figure, that unconditional support, that's something I didn't have. And I feel a loss, the loss around it, you know, to this day.
You keep looking for a mentor. You end up perpetually looking for a mentor.
Exactly. And angry with men, angry with women, you know, because I don't know how to be a man. I mean, I didn't know how to be a man in relationship to a woman, because the only woman that I, you know, the woman that I grew up with was my mother, and she was my mother. She was, you know, dominant to me. And so I didn't have an example there to show me how to be in relationship with a woman. And so there's been a lot of struggle there for me as well. But yeah, I've had great teachers. I've had great coaches through the year, but there's also something, you know, I think I've walked through life feeling like there's something inadequate about me or something wrong with me. So even certain male people who could have been father figures to me, I've probably projected some of my disowned resentment and anger toward my father for leaving onto them. And that created separation. And so wouldn't allow that guidance and mentorship in, even though I was longing for it. So it's, you know, it's been a push pull. And then ultimately, you know, you get to the point where you realize, you know, you sort of have to give it to yourself that I'm a man, but there's still that boy inside me. And that ultimately I have to father that man and find it. I don't want to say on my own, because I've had a lot of guidance, but ultimately, you know, just to feel the pain of the loss of what happened, to know that you're never getting it back. It can never be fixed or corrected. It can be healed, certainly, but that's gone, and there's repercussions, and to come to terms with that, and then figure out what you have to do to compensate for it, and then do that, and then move on.
Yeah, you essentially have to become your own father.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, we're seeing that all over the place, right? I mean, this is the generation. I mean, I think they talk about it in Fight Club, right? It's like, there's a real generation of fatherless men. And I think that's playing out in a lot of ways in the culture right now. I think there's a lot of angry men. There's a lot of lost men. I mean, you're seeing, you know, men dropping out of school, the high suicide rates, addiction, you know, not performing well. And I think a lot of that has to do with a real lack of masculine guidance in the culture.
It's almost like some people lack the skills to live life.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I feel like I'm 48 years old and I'm still learning things, right? And, you know, I grew up, like I said, with my mom and most of my primary school teachers were women, and they were great, and I learned a lot from them. But there's something that a boy needs to get from a man that a woman cannot give him, that a woman cannot understand. And there's a discipline, a kind of a firmness. I think there's a loving masculinity, but that is also firm and directional. And that is really teaching men to be of service, to live with purpose, to live with dignity. And I think a lot of that has been lost. And now that said, I think you're seeing figures in the culture emerging that are starting to fill that void. I mean, I feel like, I don't know if you're, you know, following what's going on with Jordan Peterson, but I think all of these men are drawn to him. And I think it's because he represents something about the masculine, and his message, which is self-responsibility, you know, like set yourself straight, you know, clean up your room, meet the world open and ready. Don't be afraid of confrontation. Speak your truth, like live with integrity, live for a higher purpose. I think those are all good messages that I feel like my generation, we didn't really get, or I don't feel like I got that message in quite that way, or I certainly didn't have it modeled for me.
Have you managed to make peace with your father since then?
I did, yeah. When I was, I think in my late 20s, when I started to have success as an actor, you know, I remember calling him up and telling him what was going on. I just got this TV series, and after struggling for years, waiting tables and not getting anywhere, and suddenly I broke through. And I remember him telling me that he was proud of me. And I cried on the phone. You know, I mean, I didn't let him know that I was crying, but, you know, tears came down my face, and I realized how much I'd been longing to hear him say that. And I also realized in that moment that my dad was probably had a lot of shame about what had happened, about his own alcoholism and the fact that he, you know, my mom left him, and I'm sure he had a lot of regret about it. And so I really started to see it from his side and see, you know, him as a man. And I realized if I was going to have a relationship with him, that I was going to be the one to initiate it, that I was going to have to make it happen. So I did that. I started getting into regular contact with him, because there was periods of time where there was like a 7-year period where I didn't see him, maybe a cut, and then a 5-year period where I didn't see him. So, but now we're on really good terms. I go out and visit him in Saskatoon, or he comes out here. We, you know, he's a big sports fan, so we'll go to, you know, baseball game. Went out to Boston a couple years ago. So I feel really in a good place with my father. I feel like resolved, and inside myself, I feel like I've done my work to resolve my own feelings about what happened. And so I feel really good about that, actually, that I feel that I'm clean with my dad.
You said that you got into sports when you were younger. Was this team or individual sports?
Mostly team sports. I grew up in Canada, so I was a hockey player and, you know, pretty competitive. My dad was also a competitive hockey player. And then I started playing basketball in high school, and I played basketball in university at the University of Toronto as well. And then continued in my 20s to play men's hockey when I moved to LA. So yeah, sports has always been a big part of my life. I feel like it's what kept me grounded. It's what kept me sane. It was a place that I could go and get out all my aggression. It was, you know, where that kind of aggression was allowed. I felt free there, and because I was a good athlete, it was a place where I could go and get some self-esteem. And you know, I love teams. I love bonding with men in that way. I love competing. I love being on a mission with guys. And the discipline that it takes to get better and to achieve and to win, the practice, all of it. I feel like early in life that was, you know, foundational for me.
That's interesting, because sport almost inevitably leads to a philosophy of developing oneself, or at least developing one's skill. But I find that people in sport, younger people in sport, often ignore the inner self. And I'm wondering whether you were interested in personal development at a young age, or whether this is something that came later on, and whether sport played a role in that at all.
Yeah, in a spiritual sense, not really. I didn't really start developing myself psychologically and spiritually until I was in my 20s, after I'd stopped competing as an athlete and become an actor. And you know, that's a whole different thing. Now you're talking about, you know, you're going to acting classes and you're dealing with emotions and trying to express yourself emotionally. So it was that was the time that I started to really want to understand myself. And I started going to therapy in my mid 20s, started reading like Ken Wilber, in my early 20s, you know, Zen, you know, different things, so that part of me started to open up, there. And, you know, it's been a long, long journey, but I mean, I was always interested. I mean, I remember seeing a Woody Allen movie when I was in my teens, early teens, 13, 14 on TV. And there was a scene with the psychiatrist, and, you know, Woody Allen always talks about Freud. And I was just fascinated by this idea that there was an unconscious, and that this unconscious was really controlling things for us. And there was a whole world in there that we didn't know about. And that idea fascinated me. And I wanted to know about it. You know, well, what is it? Isn't that important information? Shouldn't we know what's going on in our unconscious? I mean, otherwise, you know, aren't we just walking around sort of like robots asleep? That's how it seemed to me. And I had that sense that was true. And when I first started going to therapy and really understanding how it worked, I was determined, almost like, you know, the same determination that I had as an athlete. It's like, well, I got to get to the bottom of this. I got to figure out what's going on inside me to get whole, you know. And it almost became my mission, and it really continues to be my mission, you know, in my life. Is I just love to dig deep into my psyche and to see what's there. And also now I'm, you know, I mean, I wouldn't call myself a therapist, but I'm definitely a facilitator. And I work, you know, I lead group therapy in at least in the style of core energetics, and we can talk more about that later. But yeah, that has become essentially my life's work. And even the acting was really just a vehicle to explore myself emotionally.
Why did you go into therapy in that first instance? What did you hope to get out of it?
Well, I was struggling with a girlfriend. We were living together, and we were fighting a lot, and I could feel that there was some kind of pattern happening. And at first I was like, you know, you have problems. You need to go to therapy. And she agreed. And then she went to her session and she came back and she was like, oh my God, it was amazing. And my therapist is great. And I had such a great time. And I was instantly completely jealous and realized that I was actually the one that wanted to go to therapy. So I eventually started going, and just had an intuitive sense that there was some loop that I was in. There was some pattern that I was playing out that I couldn't figure out, and that stuff was coming up in the relationship and in my life that I wasn't in control of. And I didn't really know what it was. I just had a sense. And so I wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I started out with, I mean, I think I saw a number of therapists before I found one that I liked, you know, typical psychotherapist, and I saw a psychiatrist, and then I started seeing a Gestalt therapist. And then it was in my early 30s, after another difficult breakup with a woman that, and just also in my career, it just was in a crisis, that I discovered cornergetics, which is the therapy that I ended up studying. And that was that. That's when I knew, okay, this is for me. This is the shit. This is what I'm interested in. That was finally the one that I felt that could take me to where I wanted to go. And I started working with a guy in Toronto, and then I started going to my early 30s, about 2006. I went up to the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, and which is a famous retreat center in California, and did a week-long workshop with a woman named Ann Bradney, and was just completely blown away, not only by what happened to me, which was deep and profound, but also what I was seeing in other people, the processes that they were going through, and the impact that it was having on them, and then the skill level and technique of this facilitator, it just amazed me. And I instantly knew two things. One, I was like, I want to film this at some point, and I want to be able to do what she's doing. I want to know how is she doing this? How is she holding this? How does she know what to do and exactly what to say? I was just like, I want to know how to do that. And that started, you know, a long journey for me that really continues to this day.
You mentioned that acting was a kind of bridge between your career in sports and your becoming more introspective. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think the acting was the bridge, you know. It shifted my identity. I identified as a jock. And I think the acting opened up the more artistic, creative side of me. And then you start hanging out with different people and you start talking about different things and, you know, feelings and concepts and ideas and emotion. And then you go to acting classes and people are crying and raging and, you know, it gets very personal. I mean, believe me, sports can get very personal, but it's in a different way. It's not as vulnerable.
It's macho.
And it's also, yeah, it's macho, and it's also only men. So, yes, yeah, something that I think that transition, that was an important transition. It took me some time, obviously, to shift my sense of self. Like, you know, I felt a bit like a fraud when I started acting. You know, it's like, well, I'm not like these artsy, creative people and you know, who do this and they have real talent and they're connected to something and I'm not, I'm just a jock. And I realized that was not true. And I, I guess the other thing that I want to say is that the sports, because it's so body centered, you have a deep relationship with your body because you're training it and you're sensitive to it and you're aware of it all the time. The cornergetics is a somatic psychotherapy. It's a body oriented psychotherapy. So there's talk involved, certainly, but a lot of the work is physical. So you're hitting, you're punching, you're kicking, you're throwing tantrums. And the idea is that we have emotions held, you know, in the body and going into working with the body as a way to release those emotions directly without kind of bypassing the mind, which has an image that it doesn't want to feel this stuff, right? It's scary to feel, or it's too painful to feel. So I think my background as an athlete predisposed me to the cornergetics work. It felt like a good fit, and it was also another place where I could bring all of my energy, all of my rage, all of my power. I could bring that out in the room, and I felt free to do that in a way that I hadn't felt since I'd played sports. Because in sports, once you enter the arena, it's war, right? Everything goes. So there's a freedom in that. And I didn't, because the purpose is to win, I wasn't self-conscious. I just would play. And I wasn't thinking about how I looked or anything other than, you know, just being alive and free and going for it. And I found that same freedom in this core energetics work, particularly in the group, because, you know, the powerful thing about working in groups is you're working in relationship to people, right? Which is really where all of our wounding comes from. And where most of our issues are. So you know, in the group, all of, you know, it's like what we say, all of our people are in the group. Like your mother's in the group, your father's in the group, your brother's in the group, you know, your ex-girlfriend is in the group, and you get to play out all of these dynamics with them in a conscious way, in a deliberate way, to really get to the root of it. So, and then you're also inspired by what you're seeing. You know, somebody does something and expresses something emotionally or shares a story about their past, and you realize, oh, I really relate to that. I have that too. I feel that too. So groups are a great way to ignite feelings in people. And I think because of my history of, you know, working, you know, with teams and sports, I was comfortable in the group. It was, a lot of people are like, I couldn't go to group therapy. It's, you know, it's too vulnerable. It's, I don't want to be witnessed by other people. For me, it was the opposite. I enjoyed one-on-one therapy, but for me, group therapy is, you know, that's where I get down to business. I was an English lit major, so I just read a lot of books and wrote a lot of essays. I really studied it just because it was the only thing I was interested in. I read a lot as a kid, and I really didn't know what to major in, and I thought, well, maybe it would be sensible for me to major in business, and I was a pretty good math and science student as well, but I didn't feel called to that, and so it was actually my mother who said, you know, you love to read, you're always reading. You know, maybe it makes sense for you to do that. And so I did, and I, you know, I enjoyed it. But what happened to me was I was playing on the basketball team, and then in my second season, I got injured. And so I had all this time, I was out for the season, and I got involved in a play in some theater there. A friend, you know, pulled me in, and I did a little bit of acting for the first time. And then I immediately was enthralled by it, and then I started directing plays and slowly left the basketball behind. And then the school became less interesting for me too, because I was like, well, why do I want to, you know, read and then write an essay about this piece of literature? I can study a play and then I can put it on, you know. It felt like more interesting to me to try to figure out a way to either produce it or direct it or to act in it. And so the last couple of years of school for me, really, I did a lot of theater and just tried to get through my classwork, because I just felt like the theater was less heady. It was applying these concepts, you know, this analysis about literature, but doing it, like figuring out a way to like put it on for people and have them connect to it. I thought it was a more interesting way to study it.
You said that you were directing and producing plays. What made you pursue acting instead of directing?
That's a good question. I mean, I had this sense early on, like I said, I acted in two plays and then directed a play, and because I was drawn to directing, and immediately felt that I was actually a better director, producer than I was an actor. But I think something in my mind said, look, you can always do that later. You know, you're a young guy, and maybe now's the time to do the acting, and you'll transition, you know, eventually. And I think also there was some romance for me in being an actor. I think everybody has that to some degree. And I like the idea of, you know, meeting girls, like all the pretty actresses. It's like, I want to go, you know, kiss these girls. Which I think is a, you know, strong motivation for a lot of men.
For young guys, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was like, I, you know, turn on the TV and it's nothing but young, pretty girls. It's like, well, I want to meet those girls. So, and for whatever reason, didn't think acting and producing was the way to do that. So, yeah, I started pursuing acting. It took me a long time to get going. I did a lot of theater, but while I was in Toronto, but in terms of the film and TV world, I really wasn't getting anywhere, just bit parts and commercials and stuff. And then I finally went to New York late, you know, I was 28 years old and still wasn't really earning a living, and felt like it was my last chance. And then something happened in New York, something, I think, the knowing that it was now or never, something shifted inside me, and suddenly I could feel my work getting stronger. And I immediately got a pilot on a show for CBS, and that didn't end up going. But, you know, I think 6 months later, I had another show on NBC, and then things kind of went from there. So, but I never felt really comfortable being an actor. And especially when I work with the people who are really, really good at it and really into it, I could feel like I wasn't quite there. I mean, I was good, you know what I mean? And I was smart, and I could feel that I was castable, so that there was always going to be roles for me, or at least there at that age. But when I worked with the top people, I could feel like, oh, these guys are really good, and they're into it in a way that I'm not. And that became a crisis for me at some point, because I was successful and I was moving up the ladder, but there was some part of me that knew, like, no, this isn't your thing. There's something else for you. And that was hard, because I'd been doing well and getting a lot of ego gratification. I mean, it's, you know, when you're a successful actor, people are kissing your ass all the time, and it feels good, right? You know, you're getting recognized, and, you know, you're on set, and it's like, can I get a tuna fish sandwich? And, you know, a tuna fish sandwich shows up, and you feel very special and privileged. And it's so that part of me was digging it, and I was making good money. But yeah, right around the time that I ended up going up to Esalen to do that workshop that I was talking about, that's when I started to have my crisis, where I could just feel like I don't know how passionate I am about this, and I don't know if this is what I even want to be doing anymore. And that was tough. I'm still in that struggle in a way. Like it's shifted for me quite a bit, but I mean, I still am a working actor. I work much less than I used to, partly by choice. But once I discovered this therapy and decided I wanted to make a documentary about it, and then also I ended up enrolling it in the training, I really, you know, I had a phone call with my agent, and I said, I want to obviously keep working, but I want to do this school, and I want to prioritize that. And so there's certain times I'm not going to be available, and I want to make that a priority. And that was a real shift for me. And there was something about making the documentary that I really wanted to assert myself as a producer, as a director, discover myself in that way. And so it was right around that time, 30, 35, 36, 37, that I started pushing toward that. And that's really been going on ever since.
How does your actor training figure in the current work you're involved in? Does it help, or do you find that it's difficult to access your authentic self as a result of the training?
You know, it's funny that, like, you know, people often ask that question. It's like, are you telling the truth? You know, because you're an actor. But the truth is, when you're an actor, you're actually trying to get, that's all you're trying to do is to get to your authentic self. Or at least that's the way I approached it. I didn't think of the roles that I took as I'm going outside of myself to find this character and then play that character. It was more like, I'm going to bring this character to me. And who, in this set of circumstances that this role has put me in, how would I react? Who am I here? And so I always felt like I was trying, like, acting was a way to actually get to my authentic self. And so I for me, acting became a way of exploring that. And so in the work that I do now, I really feel the acting is a tool. I mean, what it does help with, it helps me take on different roles, you know, I would say, but like I also classify them as energies, different parts of myself that I have access to, that I can work with people in that way, because a big part of the work that I do is we do role playing, right? So if you're having a conflict with your father, it's like to step into the energy of for me to step into the energy of the father when I'm working with somebody, or the lover, and to be really present with the person, because something happens when you get really present with another human being. I mean, and that, like, for me, that's how I work with people. It's like just to drop into a deep state of presence and then to see what's there emotionally, because more often than not, it's difficult to get present with our emotions, to really be with them. And I think the actor training, I mean, that's what it trains you to do fundamentally, is to be present with your feelings and emotions, and also be witnessed in them, and to get comfortable with being seen there. So I think that the acting really helped me when I was doing the work training to get to deep places. But I think it also helps me a lot as a facilitator. It's like another tool in my toolkit.
Can you describe the workshop to me? What the focus is on, what the format is, what the process is, what the main aims are, and what the general outcomes are?
I mean, for me, it's quite simple. It's like, we all know that feeling our feelings is good for us. It's healthy. And that holding back our feelings is unhealthy, and it creates problems, I mean, physically and psychologically. And I think a lot of people are longing to feel more, and they're struggling to find a place to do that. And so for me, group is a place to go and do that, and to do it in particularly in relationship with other people. And I think people are longing for that. They're longing to be more authentic, to bring themselves out. And I think a lot of people have this feeling that, or have this sense that these held back feelings are causing problems in their lives. And it can be all kinds of things. I mean, there's really no typical reason that somebody comes, other than they feel like that they're not getting everything they can out of life. They feel like they're held back, they're confined, they're restricted, they're sad, they're depressed, they're angry, but they're not whole, they're not full, they're not fully alive. But in general, people come for all kinds of reasons, you know, but mostly all this stuff that we're all struggling with in life, you know, relationships, sexuality, heartbreak, you know, struggling in their career, struggling to you know, give their gifts to the world. So, and usually what we do, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on, but essentially what you're doing with people is you're trying to understand what their images are around the world, around themselves, you know, that are largely unconscious, and bring those out, what their limiting beliefs are, you know, and then you start to connect them back to their childhood. You know, where did this start? Where did this begin? You try to make those connections for them, and then you start to work with the feelings that are there, because, you know, as children, that parts of us, all children, there are parts of us that do not get seen or recognized, or that are not welcome, or that we learn are not okay, and we squash those feelings down. We separate from them, and that's a painful experience for a child, because that part of themselves feels like who they are. And so it's a kind of an annihilation that they experience. And everybody has that, I think, on some level, because we live in a culture, and, you know, culture has certain ideas about what's okay and what's not okay. And of course, children, you know, they need to be conditioned. You can't just allow your children to just, like, it's not a free for all, but it's how you do that. And certainly parents project a lot of unconscious things onto their children, place demands on them, and all of that creates trauma. I mean, and then never mind actually, you know, being in a truly abusive household, or growing up, you know, sexually abused or physically abused or neglected. I mean, all of that is going to create trauma. So really, we're trying to get back to the root of the trauma and allow people to feel the feelings that they couldn't feel back then. And then we work with the shadow, what we call the lower self, you know, getting into our negativity, our judgments, the parts of ourselves that, you know, can be cruel or want to hurt others, you know, as punishment. And a lot of that, those feelings are obviously deeply unconscious, and people have a lot of shame about them. But that, for me, is always the pathway. Really, that working with the shadow, that's ultimately where I'm trying to lead people, because I've found, you know, in my own personal work and in working with others, once you can take them there And once you can have them feel that part of themselves and express that part of themselves and own that part of themselves, own the part of them that's capable of destruction, capable of wanting to hurt, that could kill, you know, and that can rationalize their cruelty. And we all have that. And it's a hard thing to face, but you see it out in the world all the time. And you see it in children. And I think facing that is really, is for me, is the path to consciousness. And then once that gets acknowledged, it's really only then that you can really tap into your higher self, right? Your gifts, and to know that, you know, that there's a God and a devil that live inside you, and they coexist, and you really have to make friends with both of them.
From watching the series, I got the feeling that the workshop is a space where people are encouraged to express a lot of negative feelings that they can't express in day-to-day life. And in one episode, the one with Helga and Sonia, the two of them are encouraged to explore some animosity they're feeling towards one another. Helga, I think, isn't keen to get into a conflict because she wants to remain civil. But Anne, the facilitator, encourages her to express whatever negativity she has. And she tells her that she needs to go through the negativity to come out the other side.
Well, I think, you know, that's it, right? You know, it's like, it's hard. Like, if we go all the way, you know, into whatever we're feeling, including our negativity, including our hatred, you know, our judgment. And if we do it consciously, I mean, in these rooms where the intention is to heal, like, it will take you somewhere. And you don't know where when you're in it. And it feels wrong. And it also feels scary. And because part of the reason is that our negativity is a protection against our pain. So if you go deep into your shadow, it's going to take you to the root of your pain. And that's a hard place to go. And that's usually why people resist doing shadow work, because it's going to take you there, to your heartbreak, to your trauma, to all that, those deep, deep feelings that are locked inside you. It's a, you know, I mean, the way we see it, you know, those of us who do this work, is that the lower self is, I mean, it's more complicated than that, but in a simple sense, it's like, it's a defense, it's a protection against these vulnerable feelings. And it works, you know what I mean? If I'm cruel, if I'm negative, that keeps people away from me, that keeps people from hurting me, right? I'm going to hurt you before you hurt me. And it keeps you separate. But obviously, there's a cost that you pay for that, because we're longing for connection, love, and wholeness. So yeah, really, the path is through it, all the way through it, and then into the pain. And then once you feel that pain, that there's a liberation that comes. And I, you know, I've experienced it. I've felt it. You know, it's not a concept to me. You know, I went through it and had a deeply visceral experience of that. And once you know that, once you've had that happen to you, you feel the truth of it. And then you want to try to help other people. You want to take them there and take them through it. But it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to go there. It's hard to face. It's hard to face these parts of us. You know, I've done quite a few ayahuasca ceremonies, and I feel like there's a very similar journey that you go on. And you know, with psychedelics, you have to go through the uncomfortable feelings. You have to go into the unknown, you know, and to let go of control, let go of what you think you know, what reality feels like to you, and enter into this unknown space, which obviously the ego is going to have a lot of resistance to that, because it, you know, it wants to control, it wants to hold on. It doesn't, that's, you know, it's scary as shit, but that's where the medicine is at. You know, once you surrender, once you let go, once you enter into that space, that's where creativity lies. That's where change can really happen, you know, because you're letting go of old paradigms, old ways of seeing the world. You're letting go of certain energies, literally, in your body that you've been holding on to, and releasing them. And there's, you know, the world looks different when you come out the other side. It's more expanded. You feel more expanded. You feel more in a place of deeper truth and deeper understanding. And I feel like the closer you get to that, the closer you get to, you know, real human compassion, you know, seeing other people in not as something separate from yourself, but, you know, as part of you in some way, as just a different expression of the same life force. And so I find all of this work is fundamentally, it's brought me to a much more compassionate place inside myself, and decreased my feeling of separation from life. So, but it's not easy. It's not an easy thing, but it's worth it. It's definitely worth it.
I found the process very interesting. I think you touched upon this earlier, but it seems that when you get 15 to 20 people together in the same room, people are so different that all of them are able to find every archetype from their own lives within that group of people. And then they are simply projecting whatever their feelings are about any issues they may have had in the past onto those other people within the group, and thereby working them out.
That's it. That's it exactly. I mean, it's perfectly said. And you want that, you know, as a facilitator, you want people to work with their projection, or we'll call it, you know, their transference. You know, it takes some time sometimes to train a group or to teach them how to hold those projections, to really understand that this isn't really about this person that's standing across from you. This person represents something to you, and what they said triggers something inside you. And, you know, it's actually not personal. Now in the moment that can be a hard thing for people in the group, because the groups can be so highly charged, and if it's personal, that's fine too. You know, you can work with that, but you're always trying to bring them back to themselves. Like, what, in other words, what is this for you? I understand, you know, Joe over there said something and it triggered you, and you feel it's offensive and you want to, you know, punish him for it. But what is this inside you? And what is this from your history? Like, where does this connect to something that happened to you in your history? Because these feelings belong to you. And I think that's really the thing that I try to teach people, and that I came to understand. It's having a deep sense of responsibility for your own feelings and for your projections, and to bring them back to yourself, so that you're not constantly living in blame and at effect to the world. Which is a very disempowering place to be. It's much more empowering to move through life knowing that you cannot control other people, that people are going to do what people are going to do, and all you can do is feel what comes up inside you and take ownership of it. And certainly have your boundaries with people. You know, that's an important thing. But to know that all of this, everything that's happening in your life, all the people that you're struggling with, some part of this is connected to your history. There's something that happened to you early in your childhood that's now being played out in this moment. And once you can bring that into your consciousness, it really helps in all my relationships. You know, I'm not much less, I mean, I still do it. We all do it, but you recover quicker from the projection and the blame and the judgment. And it just makes for more honest, more real relationships.
When you set off to make this series, were you looking at any filmmakers for inspiration? Was there any major influence?
I was always a fan. I mean, I was like a fan of like John Cassavetes and Robert Altman. Those were kind of my guys. In terms of documentary, though, there was no one really stylistically that I was thinking about. I just really approached it in a practical way, which was what's the best way to film this? Like, what's... Because it's complicated. You got three cameras in the room. You have no idea what's going to happen next. Every session is 3 hours, and it's essentially one take. Like, once they start going, we've just got to go for it. So my choices were just like, what's the best, most practical way to capture this in a way that feels like I want people to feel like they're in the workshop. I want it to feel fly in the wall. So, I mean, you know, the feeling of cinema verite. And I feel like, yeah, that's kind of what I did. You know, I always feel like if, you know, John Cassavetes would have made a documentary, it would have been something like this. You know, it's wild. It's unpredictable. You often don't know where you are, what exactly is going on. So, you know, that was definitely my sensibility. And I guess, you know, consciously or unconsciously, I wanted to infuse it into the documentary. But really, it was just, I was just trying to make it work. You know, what's the best way that I can make this work?
You have some really interesting personalities in there. How did you select your cast?
Well, there was a lot of people that, you know, had been doing the work, that had been doing Anne's workshops, people that she knew, that I knew, that we felt would be really good for the workshop. So we asked them. And almost, I think I only had one person, maybe two people say no. And I think because they really felt passionate about the work and the idea of getting it out there, it was appealing to them. You know, I think they got on board with that intention. And I think there was something about, there was an opportunity to be seen in a really authentic way, in a really raw way. And a lot of people ask me, like, is that, how did you get them to do that? And, you know, I think people are longing to be seen in their authentic selves. I think they want a place to go where they can bring it all out. And I think the idea of that being captured on film was really, it was terrifying for all of them, but I think it was also really exciting. And then there was a few other people that, and we knew we needed to have some people who'd never done the work before. And those were friends of mine that I showed the trailer, and they responded to it and said yes. So I feel like really fortunate to get the group of people that we got, and they were amazing. I mean, they just went for it.
Who were the people who hadn't done the work before?
The three sisters had never done the work before, and Sam.
Oh, right.
They were the newbies. And there was a few others who had done it just maybe once or twice, but there was also a lot of experienced people in the room, which helps. You know, it helps speed the process along. They'll take risks earlier. They'll bring themselves out early in the workshop to sort of to set the tone.
The resulting footage is quite raw and very, very personal. And I'm wondering what the arrangement was with the cast regarding representation, whether there were any issues with that.
Well, I sent out a letter to them all, an email, and just said, look, if there's anything that you're afraid of, you know, if you're going to hold back anything here personally, and you feel like that's going to, you know, impact you because you don't want people to see it, you probably shouldn't come. Like, you know, we're going to go for it here. And I don't want people to be feeling like they're holding back. So I had one person drop out because of that. But I think most people, I mean, I was astonished at how raw and visceral they got and how personal they got. And I mean, I'm sure people held back specifics, you know, and which you don't, but the truth is you don't, the specifics aren't really the issue. Like the story isn't really the important thing. Oh, my mom did that. I mean, a little bit of that, but it's really about the feeling around it. So I think we were able to get around some of the more personal stuff, but you know, we got into everything. We got into, you know, physical abuse, sexual abuse. I mean, there was, you know, deep, deep trauma. I was astonished, to be honest. I remember when we were filming it, I just couldn't believe that what was happening and that people were willing to expose themselves in this way. And there was a real contraction afterwards. I think people were kind of in shock, like, oh my God, what did I just do? And I know there's people when they saw the footage were, you know, it was hard for them to see it, because it's so raw and so personal. And I think they felt, you know, shy about it, about exposing themselves in that way. But I think overall, you know, people were really, really happy with it and happy to be a part of it.
I found some of it quite tough to watch in the first instance, because the participants are exposed and you're getting to see them in a vulnerable state. You're seeing a private moment. And so at times I felt like I was intruding. But then I realized that is the power of the series, that it's letting me see something that I'm not normally privy to.
Exactly. And that was really my intention. I felt like people need to see this. They need to see what's happening in these rooms, because it's powerful and it's real and it's healing and it's exposing a part of ourselves that we're afraid, that we're, most of us are afraid to really to show, never mind the world, to show ourselves, to admit to ourselves. And I knew how impactful it was for me and what a profound influence it had on me in my life. So and the stories are so compelling, right? People, everybody's story is, you know, if you really dig into it, everybody's got an amazing story. So I felt there was a lot of great stories to tell.
You funded this project yourself, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I had been working a lot in television, and so I was making good money, and I knew that I wanted to film something. I knew I wanted to film this, and I knew the project was a little strange. And I just thought trying to go out and raise money or try. I mean, my original idea was, you know, to try to get it done as a television series, which I'm still trying to do, actually, as a documentary series. But ultimately, I just decided to shoot it myself and just fund it and then get the footage back and see what happened. And then for post-production, I did raise some money through Kickstarter. I did a Kickstarter campaign and actually raised quite a bit of money that way. And that certainly helped a lot with the cost of post-production, which was, extensive. Any kind of documentary series, that's where the time and money is really spent, because you get all this footage and then you've got to figure out a way to assemble it in some kind of cohesive story. And, you know, there was so much to go through. It was a bit of an, and I did most of it, I mean, almost all of it, really, on my own. So it was an overwhelming task, which is why it took me about 5 years to finish.
Of course, if you're funding something yourself, then you're only responsible to yourself. But if you're raising money on Kickstarter, suddenly you have responsibilities, right?
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the reasons I did the Kickstarter campaign, because I felt like I needed that leverage to be responsible to somebody, to a group, to the group of people who contributed, because I was struggling to finish it. You know, I can be a bit of a perfectionist, and like I said, I was overwhelmed doing it all by myself. And I thought that, well, if I raise some money and these people contribute, I'm going to have to push through whatever resistance that I'm having and the procrastination and the fear, really, of putting it out there, because this was the first time I made a film, and I was insecure about my artistic sensibilities, and if I knew what I was doing, and if it was any good, and were people going to respond to the subject matter, and of course, like a lot of artists, all you can see is the mistakes, you know, all the things that I had done wrong, and I became kind of obsessed with that, but I slowly started to get over that. But yeah, the Kickstarter really helped with the leverage and to give me some a completion date to work toward. Otherwise, I'd probably still be working at it. You know, what do they say? A film is never finished. It's only abandoned. That's how I feel, for sure.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago that you're thinking of making a TV series. Are you thinking about this footage with this group of people, or are you thinking about doing a whole other group?
No, it'd be a whole other group. I mean, so basically what happened was we took about 3 years ago, we assembled some highlights and took them out to different production companies around Los Angeles. And we got a lot of good response, actually, because the footage is very interesting and compelling, and it's unlike anything really that's out there. So we did do a round of pitching to a lot of the network. I mean, we pitched everywhere, really, HBO, Showtime, you know, the own Oprah's network, and all over the place. And people loved the footage. They were very moved by it. They had a lot of questions, but ultimately we did not sell it. And I'm not sure why exactly. I think in some ways we probably didn't frame what it was clearly enough. And it is a bit hard to understand exactly what it is. And unless you really, like I was saying earlier, unless you really experience it. So I just don't think we articulated it clearly. Or who knows, maybe the time wasn't right. But the production company called us up about 6 months ago and said, we want to go out with it again. We feel that maybe the time is right for it, especially with everything that's going on, you know, in the world and certainly in the United States. There's, you know, so much division, so much anger, that the idea that, you know, we could get people together and really express what's going on inside them emotionally and try to get to the root of it and explore it in an emotional way. As opposed to the cognitive dialogue that's going on, right? Like people talking about all of the issues. And there's always an underlying emotional component to it. And I think what's going on right now is there's just a lot of fear. There's a lot of change happening, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of instability. And I think people are really afraid. And so the idea that we could get a group of people together and really go into that stuff, go into those issues, I think is it could be really, really interesting because we do go into conflict, you know, personal conflict. So, yeah, we're out. We're getting ready to go out for another round of pitching here in L.A. soon. And, yeah, I'm very hopeful. I think it could be a really interesting series. So it would be a new group of people. You know, who knows? It could be themed. It could be Democrats and Republicans. It could be men and women. It could just be a group of people without a kind of theme, but there's a lot of ways that we could go with it. And I think that I'm really excited about it. And I would like to see it get out there in a bigger way. The version that I did, that's definitely one way to approach it in terms of just, you know, how I put it together. But I think there's another version that exists that could do really well on television, probably somewhere like Netflix or HBO. I think it needs the space of those kind of networks where, you know, there's, you can swear and go into the weird areas to really explore what's going on there. But I think it could be really, I don't know, I think it could be really interesting television. So I'm excited about that.
Well, one of the nice things about having a web series is that one doesn't have to conform to the TV format. So in your series, the length of each episode is determined by the point it needs to make. And one episode says everything it needs to say in 5 minutes, and then you have an episode which is an hour in length. I'm thinking about the hour-long episode now, Men's Group. For the first 30 minutes or so, it's not really clear what's happening and what the point of the process is. So yeah. It's a bit frustrating. It was a bit frustrating for me as a viewer. But then I realized that that is exactly the point, that that's what the people in the group are experiencing. Now, I can't imagine TV giving you that amount of time to just sit with something and observe it.
Yeah.
But maybe a streaming platform might be a good place for it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because that version exists, the version that, you know, my version is out there, and it's that I was able to do that exactly as you described, I feel more open to the idea of a version that's a little more mainstream, a little more digestible for a wider audience. I don't think I would have felt that way if I hadn't done my series first, you know, and really got it out the way that I wanted. Because it is hard to sit with it. And I wanted people to feel what the participants are feeling. That was the whole idea. And so there is a lot of uncomfortable moments or awkwardness or like, what is going on here, and frustration, because that exists. That's part of these groups, you know, and it's part of what ignites the feeling inside us. I didn't want the experience to be comfortable always for people. I wanted it to be challenging, confronting. I wanted them to feel. And I think there's a way to also do that in a version for television, but also, you know, just make it a little bit more accessible, because, you know, I want people to see it. I want people to connect to it. I want them to relate to it. And I think there's a way to do that and still keep it all in its integrity. And probably that would involve more exploration into the characters that we really, I mean, that definitely exists in my version. But I really let it live inside the room, you know, in real, not exactly in real time, but the feeling of like you're with it in real time. But I think following the stories of the people in it and going deeper into that and having more interviews with people, I think that would be probably the approach to the television series. And the production company we're working with, they really get it. They want this thing to live in its integrity, because it's you don't want to sensationalize it, you know, You don't want to turn it into some kind of reality show. I think that would be a real disservice. But I don't think certainly the production company working with, they're not interested in doing that. And I don't think any network that would get involved would really be interested in doing that. I think when people see the footage and if they respond to it, they want to do it right. You know, they want to put it out there in a good way.
Which characters do people respond to the most?
I think people really respond to, I mean, Mike, people respond to him in a lot of different ways. You know, he provokes a lot of feeling in people. And he's in it, you know, throughout, and he brings himself out in a very intense way. So I think people were, you know, scared of him or freaked out by him or disturbed by him, but also very admiring of his courage and his willingness to speak his truth. So Mike is definitely a big character. Sam, obviously, because he's so sensitive and because it was his first time and because he's so articulate with his experience. Sonia, I think, is a powerful character also because it was her first time and because of her willingness to really jump into it and go for it and reveal herself and be honest. And excuse me, the three sisters in general, I think that story is quite remarkable, that you get these three sisters together who have this really intense family history and they go right into it. They go, you know, each one of them has incredibly powerful moments in the series, and to see them bond around that, I found them incredibly moving. Helga obviously is a very powerful character. And then I love them all, but then the family story, the Wood family, I think is also Ron and Brian, the son confronting his father, you know, expressing his disappointment. I think that's a really universal story. And we also see that in the men's group, and a very powerful one and an archetypal one, you know, and the father feeling the pain of how he's let his sons down. And then seeing that worked through, and then seeing them come together. I found that to be an incredibly powerful moment. So, and the other character that is really compelling is David Estrada, who just passed away actually, recently. Yeah, he had cancer a couple years ago, so he's been terminal. Very sad. But his character is really, he's the linchpin in a sense, because if you actually go back and watch the whole thing, he ignites so much because of his willingness to, excuse me, his willingness to just speak his truth. And he's very...
To be a confrontational, to be a bad guy.
Yeah. Exactly. You need that character in the group. You need the bad guy. You need the villain. And he's the villain in the show. And I always felt like the villain is the agent of change, because their willingness to speak out this thing that they see and then stand in it, it creates so much. And there's a scene actually that's not in the series where he's the first one to get up and say, you know, I don't trust anybody here. I don't like this. I think this is all bullshit. Like, I mean, he just opens it up right out of the gate, and he ignites, the Wood the Wood family story. He's the one who says, you know, I feel like you guys are like a clan. He triggers all kinds of stuff there. He ignites Sonia in the episode with Sonia and Helga. He's very powerful in the men's group, obviously, in his confrontation with Ron. So he's all over the place. And that character's, you know, very, very important. And in every group needs a villain. You have to have that person who's willing to say those things out and then face the repercussions. And he did it with Kathy as well. I mean, that's a very powerful episode where, you know, I don't know how clear it was, but there was an exercise where they had to walk around and say something to people that felt like a risk. So you'll go and you meet people just walking around, you stop in front of them, and each person, it's like, what's a risk for me to say to this person? And he said to Kathy, who has cerebral palsy and, you know, struggles to speak clearly, that he has a hard time listening to her talk, which is a really, you know, it's quite a thing to say to her. But it ignited her process. It ignited her rage and took her somewhere very powerful. So,
and she kicked his butt for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And she got, but she got to feel all of that, right? And that's something that I learned very early on in group, that and that Anne articulates very well. Whatever you're feeling, you know, just say it out. Like, don't judge it. Don't worry about if it feels right or wrong. Just say it out, and it will always lead somewhere. That the truth coming out, even if it's dark, even if it's connected to your shadow, even if it's judgmental, it's in the room anyway. People, it's in the room as a vibration. I mean, it's all there, right? So it coming out, it always ignites something that if the facilitator is skilled, and obviously Anne is, you can take it somewhere. So that's a really interesting thing, and it's a hard thing for people to understand, and it's one of the reasons that I think it's so powerful, that, you know, group, is that it is an opportunity. You can go in there and you can say anything you want. You know, you don't have to hold back anything. And we don't get to do that in society very often. We're very careful with what we say and how we say things. And not in group. You're allowed to just, you know, bring it all out. And it can lead to some very, very powerful places.
Something else that I found interesting was that Mike, who has issues with women, would gravitate towards Sonia. And she's the one person in the room who does not want men gravitating towards her.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing how that happens, right? And, you know, I mean, I don't want to deconstruct that, you know, too much in a sense. But, you know, that's, who knows what's going on there. There may have been a negative intention there. You know, he does work that out. There's one of the extras where he really gets into, you know, his hostility with women. And so there might have been an unconscious intention to provoke her or to agitate her, and which is one of the things that happens in group. Like when you start to follow your impulses and just move and towards whatever you want to move toward, or a person that you want to move toward without really thinking about it, often a lot of shadow stuff gets revealed. And again, all of that ended up being a real gift to Sonia. She had an opportunity to work out with, because Mike was coming at her, she then had an opportunity to work out a lot of her stuff with men and work on her boundaries and saying no, and because she had a lot of sexual trauma from her past and abuse from men. So that's the thing that happens over and over again. You know, you have these people get drawn to each other for very complicated reasons, and often unconsciously. And as a facilitator, you know, you have to move through that stuff very, very slowly. But there's often an opportunity there to, if you are careful, to really deconstruct something and figure out what is our unconscious patterning here? What is causing us to move toward this? And whatever it is, there's always an intention to heal. You know, there's some part of, I think, each of them that knows that moving toward each other somehow can facilitate their own healing. And I think that happened, you know, for both of them. I think something really shifted for both of them. And they both had the opportunity to really express themselves. And I think you see it in the extra where Mike really confesses how dark his sexuality is and his impulses towards women. And he brings it out directly, and he brings it out directly to Sonia. And what we see that's underneath it is a real fear, you know, that he had been hurt badly by his mother. He'd been shamed sexually. And he had a rage reaction, intention to hurt and punish as a response to that. And Sonia, somebody who, you know, had a history of abuse, didn't know how to really have her boundary, didn't really know how to learn how to say no, didn't know that it was okay to say no. So they have this beautiful moment where he really reveals his simple truth, which is that he's attracted to her. and then he wants to be closer to her. And she has the opportunity to say, you know, that's wonderful, and but I, you know, I'm not interested. And it's a really clean, pure moment. But it's hard. That stuff is really hard in groups. You know, it's hard to deconstruct it. It's hard to and it's hard to work with it because, again, you're working with people's deep trauma. And it's complicated, and the psyche is complicated, and we get motivated by all kinds of strange unconscious things. So, yeah.
I also found that the most unsettling moments in the series were the sequences where men were displaying emotions, some of them very dark emotions. And maybe they're so unsettling because we're not used to seeing men getting emotional or reacting that strongly. Have you had any feedback from female viewers on how they find the more emotionally charged scenes that feature the men?
It's split, I would say, in that I think it is disturbing to some women to see the extent of the rage that a lot of men have toward women. And there is a relief that they're seeing it come out, in a sense, because I'll think a lot of women feel it, and obviously they feel it every day. And so that's always my experience in group. When the darkness comes out, it, for me, it often feels like a relief because it, something about it being liberated and seen and exposed, it's like it becomes safer. And when it's underground, when it's unconscious, it feels like it's more dangerous. So, you know, those scenes, I remember when we were filming them, I was just like, I don't know what to do with this. Am I going to include this? Like, this is dark, you know, cause we're going into rape fantasy and, you know, the darkest parts of sexuality. But I think it's important to see because, you know, what is underlying this male sexual aggression? Like what's underneath it? You know, where does it come from? And I think the series shows that quite a bit in David's process and with Mike, we really get to see what's underneath it. And I think for some people it's too much. It's just simply too much. And particularly David's episode, you know, and it comes later in the series. So my hope was that by the time they get to that point, the viewer, they're sort of acclimatized to the series. They have an understanding of what it is and how the process works so that when they get to that moment, they're prepared for it in some way. Although I don't think anybody can be quite prepared for that moment. And I mean, even within the group, you could feel the shock afterwards, you know, of that darkness coming out. It's a lot to process. It's a lot to hold. And it's very uncomfortable, you know. But I feel like something really deeply healing happened in that moment for David, but also for everyone in the group, and that all of us have this darkness that lives inside us, and women too. I mean, women have their own dark sexuality. It comes out, I think, in a different way, but, you know, we were talking about this earlier. It's like that to me, that this shadow work, that the willingness to go all the way into the darkest elements of our psyche is why I find this work so compelling. And I and that there's not just a vehicle to do it, but there's really techniques that can really help take you there because they're difficult places to go. They're difficult places to access because we're so cut off from them. And it's so shame. They're so taboo, you know, but it's important that they're revealed and that we can see them for what they are. Because they're playing themselves out every day. I mean, you see it in the Me Too movement. I mean, I would love to get these people in a room and to process that, you know, like what these men who are sexually aggressive, like what's going on there for them? And in some place in their history, they must have gotten hurt or their sexuality somehow got twisted. And I think it's particularly important to see men work through that and to see what's underneath it and to see to really see the pain that's underneath it, because you see it with David and Mike. Like, they both had in their history places, they just felt like they'd been annihilated by women at a very, very young age, you know, whether it was by their mother or some other caregiver, that somehow they'd been deeply shamed and humiliated around their sexuality and controlled and coerced. And that their response to that was, a terror response, but on top of the terror was this rage, this desire to then punish women for what had been done to them. So I'm very proud of that. The series shows that stuff, and we go there. I think it's important to see that. I also think it's hard for a lot of people to really digest. It's a lot to process, and I think it's. For some people, it's definitely too much.
Did you get any response from Mike or David or Sonia about the series?
Everybody's got mixed feelings about it. I mean, everyone really likes it. You know, Sonia loves it. Mike, he likes the series. You know, David as well. Everybody had a strong response to it, but it's hard for them to see themselves in that way. There's still a lot of, like, the level of exposure there is so intense. All of them have this feeling, like, I think that they're really proud. I want to say all of them. I can't speak for all of them because I haven't heard from all of them. But for the people that I've heard from, that they're really proud of it, that they're really proud that it's out there. They feel the goodness of it. But there is some shyness about how exposed they are and the vulnerability of it, because of course you don't know how people are going to interpret what it is they're seeing. And that's, you know, one of the things you learn as a creator. You put something out and you have an intention and it means something to you, but once it's out there in the world, people are going to interpret that through the lens of their own experience, and you can't really control that. So you want it to be received in the way that it was intended. You want people to understand it, have compassion for it, but they don't always, you know.
Have you had any negative reactions?
The truth is, the vast majority of people that watch it are really moved by it. And they say things like, I've never seen something so real, people exposing themselves in that way. And they feel it's very profound. That's the vast majority of it. But I think what happens is, you know, because we're taking you right inside the process, because there's not a lot of explanation about what's happening, so there's not the distance, in a sense, from it. You're really right in it. People often have strong emotional reactions. So if you have a history with sexual abuse and you're watching Mike or David work, you might feel disgust or revulsion or rage or anger to that. And people have that. I mean, there's people who've just, like, I could not stand Mike. Oh my God. I just, you know, I wanted to just kill him. And it's perfect in a way, right? Because if you were in the group, you would use that, you know, you'd have that person stand up and process, and what is this for you? And what does Mike bring up in you? And what is this from your history? And they could express their rage or their disgust, whatever it is. So, you know, and that's what happened when we pitched the show around town. We'd go into these rooms and we'd show people footage, and people would get triggered. You know, they'd start, often we wouldn't be talking about the series at all. We'd just be talking, we'd end up, like, processing these people because they'd see this footage and they'd have a very powerful emotional reaction. And that everybody responds to a different thing, right? And I think that's always true. You're always surprised by what people react to. And I certainly was with this.
Do you find that viewers judge the characters in the series? Because if they do, then that obscures the process of the workshop. So it's probably something that you don't want, right?
I mean, it is and it isn't, right? Because when you're in the group, that's what you do. You're judging people. And you want people to judge people. You know, you want them to bring out their judgments, because there's always something underneath the judgment. And so you're always working with that inside the group. And we all want to try to rise above it and hold the greatest possible intention. But the truth is, once we're in it, we're in the muck of it. We're in the humanity of it. And we're triggered by each other. We judge each other. And so there's part of me that, like, when I hear people having judgments about the characters, I'm like, well, it's perfect. It's like they were, it's like they were in the group. You know, that's what it's like to be in the group. So you just sort of let it ride, and as long as they keep watching, you know, as long as they're compelled to keep watching, and it seems like people are. And I'm always shocked when people get all the way through it, you know, because it is so strange and weird and uncomfortable at times, and especially when people get all the way through it when they're not even sure that they like these people, or they like what's happening, or they have a lot of judgment about it. So there's something that tells me that they're compelled by it, that they're learning something from it, that something is being woken up inside them, and even if they have resistance to it, something's happening for them. And so that's really my hope. Whether people understand it on a conscious level or not, that they're having an emotional experience, and that some part of their feeling is being woken up inside them, and they're starting to access a different part of themselves. Because we have so many feelings that are buried. And I think people don't even really understand that it's possible to express this stuff. I mean, I think there's a lot of shock. They've just never seen people do this before. And that's how I felt, you know. And then I also get a lot of people say, oh my God, I want to do that, but I could never do that. That's a very common reaction, because it's very, very scary, because you're going to confront these deep parts of yourself, and there's no way you're not going to be changed. Something, you're not the same afterwards, and you will never be the same, because once you access those parts of yourself, the world just looks different. You relate to yourself in a different way, and it's almost like there's no going back. And some people continue to go and do that work. Some people just go once, and that's enough for them. But some veil gets pulled down, and your whole sense of reality gets shifted. At least that was my experience. And really, every time I go, that happens. You know, every time a new layer of emotion is revealed inside me, it's like my whole perception shifts. And that's when your perception shifts, your identity, something about your identity, the thing that you hold on to that feels like you, gets challenged. And that's a very hard thing for people to confront, you know, because then you're walking into the unknown. You know, this person that I thought I was, I'm actually, there's another layer, there's something underneath, and to confront that and then try to integrate that into your being is not an easy thing to do. So, you know, I always say this, I have a tremendous amount of admiration for anybody who does this work. I feel like it takes so much courage, and I feel like they're doing something good, obviously for themselves, but for the world. Like, every person that has an intention to try to heal themselves, I think that healing, it goes out, and it affects yourself, obviously, but affects all those around you. It affects your family. It affects everybody you come into contact with. And it's no easy journey, but for those of us who are, you know, drawn to that path, it almost becomes, like, for me, it's just what I do now. You know, it's what I'm interested in, and it's a never ending. It's really a never ending process, and something that I know that is going to be going on for the rest of my life, and that I'm never going to get to the bottom of it. You know, that I've had that realization recently. It's like I can only get so far in this lifetime, and there's only so much I can undo of my childhood conditioning, and so all I'm going to try to do is become as conscious as I can, and aware as I can, knowing full well that I'm never really going to get to the bottom of it. And then there's something that happens there where you have to accept your humanity. You have to accept that you're always going to have blind spots. You're not always going to see things. You're always going to have a shadow inside you that you're not totally conscious of. But are you willing to continue to look at it? That's really all you can ask of yourself. That you're always willing to keep changing and growing.
It's a practice, like meditation or yoga.
That's exactly right. That's what I say to people when they ask about the work. Like, how many times do you have to go before you're, you know, healed? And I'm like, oh, it's not really like that. It's a practice. You know, this work is a practice.
Is there an episode that you favor above the rest? I know the one that's the longest.
I probably, the men's group is my favorite episode. It was the hardest one to edit. That was a 2-hour process that I had to cut down to an hour. I'm very happy with how it turned out. And I think it's got so many interesting twists and turns. And I think it resolves itself in a really interesting way. And I'm very interested in men's issues, you know. We see it in the culture right now. It's, you know, people are calling it a crisis in masculinity, or, you know, I'm not sure if that's what it is. But certainly something is going on with men right now. And I'm interested in it. And I've done my work around it. Meaning I've gone into, you know, my own stuff, my own masculinity, my own pain and my own fear. And that's not something I think a lot of men do. It's mostly women drawn to this work. It's mostly women drawn to therapy in general. Most therapists are in fact women. And I think men do process their emotions in different ways than women. That's something that I've seen over and over again. And so, and there can be a bias actually. And that happens sometimes with these groups, with Anne in particular, where she has, she's a woman and there's a way that I think she approaches it from that point of view. And something with men gets missed. And so I like that men's group evolved out of that. And it came from a confrontation where the male assistant said, "You're something you're not seeing as a woman. There's something you don't understand with men. And you're missing something." He was very, very angry about it. And she said, "You're right. I'm sure that's true. And so take this opportunity, go for it. You lead, you do it." And so I love that episode for that. Very meaningful to me, and I spent a lot of time cutting it together and making sure that I got it as good as I could get it.
What was it that Anne was missing? What part was the assistant talking about?
I think a lot of men have a lot of pain around not having strong masculine presence in their life, you know, and strong leadership and directional leadership and firm boundaries and love and compassion. But also like a firm guidance, you know, and I think men are suffering from that, you know, and also distant fathers who weren't, that's my experience, a father that wasn't quite there. And I think there's a real longing for that in men. And I think when that longing doesn't get met, it comes out in rage, right? But underneath, when what we saw in that episode is underneath the rage is this pain, you know, and that what ends up happening is they end up coming together to support each other in a soft way, in a vulnerable way, but in a way that's different. You know, they do it differently than women. I think that it's really hard for women to understand how painful it is for a boy not to have his father. I think there's a way that fathers and sons relate to each other, and there's a love between them that a mother and women can't quite understand. And so there ends up being a more of a maternal approach. And I feel a paternal approach to how to try to reconcile that. And I've felt that in the work that I've done, particularly when you're working with a female leader, that there's something that gets missed. There's sometimes that I need a man. I need that perspective. But I think men need to come together and do their work, and they need to do it with other men without women around. I think it's a really important thing. And I see it going on. I mean, I see more and more men's groups springing up. There's a real, I think, a very positive men's movement. I mean, I think there's negative men's movements out there that are a reaction to, you know, a defensive reaction to feminism. But I'm really seeing a positive masculinity start to emerge in the culture, and I pay a lot of attention to it. So, you know, I think that's why that episode has so much meaning for me.
How has making this series affected you?
I think it taught me about myself as a creative person. I was aware of myself as a creative person, as an actor. But when you're acting, you're always, you know, there's a certain amount of creative autonomy that you have, but you're saying other people's words, you know, you're being directed by a director. So you are of service to something that's bigger than you. But this was really my project. You know, I conceived it and I shot it and edited it and music. I mean, it was really all me. So, and it was the first time I'd ever done anything like that. And I wasn't sure that I could do it. I wasn't sure that I had the chops. I didn't, know if it would be any good. I knew that the material was going to be compelling, but could I figure out a way to put it together that was going to be compelling for an audience and really get to the heart of it? In the editing, I really started to understand my creative process, started to trust my instincts, understand and embrace my aesthetic. So it changed me. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was, you know, I stepped into myself as an artist, I think, for the first time, and learned a lot. And I'm anxious to make more. I'm not sure what that's going to look like, but I'm anxious to continue this journey into my creativity. And it also took a lot out of me. It was such an immense challenge. It took me to the heart of a lot of my issues around my insecurities, self-worth, or not feeling smart, or I grew up a jock, so there's some part of me that always, you know, the artsy people in school look down at the jocks, right? And I think I took that on, and I was never one of them. It took me a long time to really see myself as a creative person. So this was really my coming out. But emotionally it was difficult, you know, and I had a lot of dark nights of the soul while I was making this, a lot of doubt and fear. And I was also terrified that I was going to let the people down, the people who'd agreed to be in it, because I'd felt that they had taken such an immense risk to be in it. And I was terrified of letting them down or cutting it together in a way that didn't feel in its integrity to them. And certainly, there was things I had to cut out. I think people were disappointed in certain ways. And I think there were certain episodes that, you know, look, when you're editing, you're definitely shaping a perspective. I mean, look, I see the process, you know, through my eyes, right? So, but I tried to represent it as honestly as I could, but you're always on some level interpreting what you're seeing and putting it together in some way. So I think there was, you know, some people that felt a little bit disappointed with certain things, but overall, like I said, the response was really good, and I feel very proud of it now. I don't think that was always the case. I think, you know, like I said, I only saw the mistakes. I only saw the things that I didn't like. But I recently watched it. I hadn't looked at it for a couple of years. And somebody, a friend of mine who'd never seen it, we sat down and I watched it with him. And with that distance, I think I started to appreciate what it was and felt very, very proud of it.
Thank you for downloading this episode of DogPod. For more information about David Sutcliffe and other filmmakers, please visit us at thedogpod.net.